Hello, political learners. Welcome to the Weekly Paul Show. My name is Tobias Sika. I'm a fourth-year Bishop's graduating student doing a double major in political science and German as a foreign language, and I will be your host for this show. This week, I will be speaking about the recent political deal broken between the New Democrats of Jagmeet Singh and the Liberals of Justin Trudeau. Why is the current government at risk of falling in the upcoming month? And why could Pierre Poilievre, the leader of the Conservative Party of Canada, become the next Prime Minister? All of this and much more in a few minutes. Canada is a federal parliamentary constitutional monarchy, and I will define each of these terms in the following minutes. What does it mean to be a federal system? In Canada's case, Canada has 10 provinces and 3 territories that possess a constitutional division of power between the provincial and the federal level of government. This separation of power is clearly mentioned in Articles 91, 92, and 93 of the Constitution, and cannot be overstepped by either the provinces or the federal government. Here are some examples of powers within the federal domain: nuclear energy, citizenship, foreign affairs, currency, the postal service, census, statistics, national defense, navigation, fisheries, banking, indigenous peoples, and reserves, and railroading, with many more. On the other hand, provincial legislative powers include municipalities, education, healthcare, property, civil rights, to name a few. Some powers are shared between both levels of governments, so the federal and the provincial level contemporarily. These include official languages, agriculture, immigration, old age pension, natural resources, and taxations, and many more. As some of you may know, the Canadian federal government goes by the motto peace, order, and good government, whereas the US government goes by life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The current constitutional setting relies on different fundamental aspects inscribed in written and non-written constitution. The first written elements of this constitution comes from the British North American Act of 1867, and it's pretty much the basis of the constitution. Then, we have the Statute of Westminster from 1931, which gave de facto full autonomy to what was then the Canadian Dominion, which would become Canada. The Constitutional Act of 1982 was the last modification brought to the Constitution and is known as patriation. What happened then is basically that until 1982, the British Parliament and the British government were the sole legislators who could take care of amending or altering the Constitution. To remedy this situation in 1982, the Liberals under Pierre-Éliott Trudeau, the current Prime Minister's father, decided to patriate the Constitution. That is, to officially bring it back to Canada, and so far, it was the last time that the written constitution got amended. From the Westminster system, we also have constitutional conventions, which are unwritten rules of constitutional status. Constitutional conventions could theoretically be ignored without any immediate legal effect. However, this would create a political earthquake if they were to be ignored, because they are expected to be followed by the modern political systems because of their quasi-constitutional status. In this podcast, I will be mentioning some notable constitutional conventions. The current system is a mix between the American system, which has a clear constitution and clearly defined rules, and the British system, which has a written and unwritten set of constitutional rules accrued over time. Because Canada inherited the Westminster system, the system found in London, England, it inherited in great part its political function and lore. With the division of power, on one side you have the executive branch, comprised of the crown, represented by the king, currently being Charles III. For my European and American audience who are wondering, why on earth do we have the British monarchy? To this, I have two answers to you. First, tradition. We were part of the former British Empire, and we did not have any radical break from the UK, such as the American Revolution, for our southern neighbors. And second, because it is very hard to remove the monarchy in the Constitution. For those of you who are unfamiliar with the Canadian process to become a republic or to have some sort of other monarchy, not only would we need to have a majority of the population that agrees with republicanism, but all 10 provinces would need to agree to such modification. This makes for a change in the political structure very, very challenging, and unlikely in the near future because of current regional and interprovincial tensions, despite roughly two-thirds of Canadians wanting to move on with the current system. Justin Trudeau, our current Prime Minister, also argued that the current constitutional setting, with the British Crown as our head of state, is a marker of political stability in a world afflicted with conflicts and economic turmoils. Because the monarch, who is technically known as a Canadian monarch, does not permanently sit in Ottawa or in this country, he or she is represented by the Governor General, which is the de facto head of state here in Canada. Currently, the position is held by Mary Simon, our first Native American Governor General. Now, the head of government is represented by the Prime Minister and ministers, which together form the cabinet in Canada's federal system. Regarding the legislative power, Canada has a legislative body, the Parliament, characterized by two chambers, the House of Commons, the lower chamber, and the Senate, the upper chamber. In this podcast, I'll be mostly focusing on the House of Commons and its roles within Canada's democracy. I will not touch too much on the Senate, but what I can say is that the Senate is comprised of 105 senators, who, unlike the House of Commons, are not elected, but nominated by the Governor General on advice of the Prime Minister. That there, too, is a constitutional convention. Senators generally serve in the Senate until they reach 75 years of age, their retirement age. And because senators are appointed and not elected, they serve longer terms and deal with more politically risky issues. They also somewhat represent the various Canadian regions, although not as strongly as their American counterparts in the US Senate. The last division of power, the judiciary, is comprised of Canada's courts and most notably the Supreme Court of Canada, who is the ultimate court of appeal, making final judiciary decisions that are non-appealable. You are hearing the Weekly Pulse Show with Tobias Sika, and this week is on Canadian elections and the government that might fall. In this second section, I will be speaking about elections and political representation in the House of Commons. That is to say, the democratic mechanisms functioning to elect a government and to topple a government. The House of Commons is divided into 338 seats representing 338 electoral districts across the country, called constituencies or ridings. Each seat or each riding has only one member of parliament elected. With the recent increase in Canada's population, ridings, and consequently the number of seats in the House of Commons, will increase to 343 seats and members of Parliament. According to the Canadian Constitution, elections must be held at least once every 5 years. Since 2007, elections are established at a fixed date every 4 years, although they can be called before if the government falls, or if the Prime Minister asks the Governor General to dissolve the House of Commons. The Governor General dissolves the House on advice of the Prime Minister, which is another constitutional convention, or if the House loses confidence through a confidence vote. We often hear this saying, but what is a confidence vote? A confidence vote in Canada is a constitutional convention that requires the Cabinet to be approved by the House. It is like an acceptance vote, if you will. It's a vote to either hire or fire the government. If a confidence vote passes by simple majority in the House of Commons, the government is hired. It is assumed. It is validated. If not, it fails, and it falls effectively as if it were to be fired by the House of Commons. Now, you might be wondering what constitutes a confidence vote. Well, there are certain legislative pieces that are automatically considered as confidence vote. A first is the speech from the throne. A speech from the throne opens every new session of Parliament and is given by the Governor General to dictate the Prime Minister's and the government's priorities and policies. At the end of the speech, there is a vote. If this vote doesn't pass by a simple majority in the House of Commons, the government is toppled. Then there are budget legislations, legislations that pertain with government spending, taxes, everything that the government collects and spends on fiscally. If that does not pass through a simple majority vote in the House, the government falls. Furthermore, any major piece of government reforms that could potentially be central to a political party's platform, such as if the government wished to completely overhaul the political system without modifying the constitution, could be considered a confidence vote. The cabinet could also choose to nominate a normal legislative piece as a confidence vote, although doing so, especially if it's not sure to have a simple majority to support it in the House, is very risky. Then there is the other confidence vote category, with explicit confidence or non-confident vote that usually come from the opposition. For example, recently Pierre Poilievre, the leader of the official opposition in Ottawa, attempted twice to bring up a non-confidence vote using a simple formulation as following: the House has no confidence in the Prime Minister and in the government. If the confidence vote is rejected, or the no-confidence vote receives a simple majority, the government falls and the Governor-General dissolves the House. The Prime Minister can also request the Governor-General to dissolve the House of Commons, in which case the Governor-General will generally agree by constitutional convention, unless the Governor-General reasonably expects the Prime Minister to have an easy, simple majority, such as when the Prime Minister has its party with a majority in the House of Commons. Once the House of Commons is dissolved, the country goes into an election. Election periods, by law, need to last at least 37 days and no more than 51 days. Generally speaking, several candidates run in each of the 338 ridings across Canada. In each riding, the candidate that has a plurality of vote, that is to say, the most votes out of any other candidate, but not necessarily a majority, wins the riding. An example is if you have in a specific riding candidate A, candidate B, candidate C, and candidate D. Candidate A receives 40% of the total votes of the riding. Candidate B receives 30% of the vote. Candidate C receives 20% of the vote, and candidate D 10%. Even though no candidate has a simple majority or has obtained a simple majority, meaning 50% plus 1 of the popular vote, candidate A wins because he or she receives a plurality of vote, or if you will, the most vote in that riding. This system is called first past the post and has some advantages and disadvantages. The first advantage you could think of is simplicity. First past the post are the simplest form of democratic representation, and they are electoral systems generally used in Westminster parliamentary systems. Second, first-past-the-post systems are easy to understand because they only have one winner, which is the candidate with most votes in proportion to other candidates, defining a clear winner. Third, first-past-the-post systems tend to create more majority government rather than minority government. A majority government is a government where the party in the House of Commons has 50% plus one seats in the House of Commons. A minority government, on the other side, has a plurality of seats without having a majority in the House of Commons, like it is the case with the current Liberals of Justin Trudeau. Fourth, first-past-the-post systems allow to create a strong connection, a strong relationship between the members of Parliament elected and its constituencies, so its voters. Yet, this system also possesses disadvantages. First, first-past-the-post systems tend to favor larger parties or electorally popular parties in contrast with smaller parties. They also tend to favor geographically concentrated political interests such as the Bloc Québécois, which I will return to in a few minutes. They are also democratically skewed, where the party that receives the most seats isn't necessarily the one that receives the most votes. An example of this scenario can be taken in the last federal elections in 2021, where the Conservatives actually won more in the popular vote than the Liberals. However, they won less ridings and got less seats than the Liberals in the House. A common misconception that exists in Canada of voting with the first-past-the-post system is that you really don't actually vote for the Prime Minister or for a political party. Rather, you vote for someone presenting himself or herself in your constituency, which is affiliated with a political party. After the election is done and the results are in, the party with the most members of parliament gets a chance to form the government by constitutional convention. If the vote of confidence passes, the party forms the government, and its leader becomes prime minister of the country. If not, the second largest party gets a shot. This usually happens with minority governments, and if no party manages to obtain the House's confidence, then the Governor General can dissolve Parliament and call for new elections. You are hearing the Weekly Poll Show with Tobias Sika, and this week is on Canadian elections and the government that might fall. Now, on to political parties in Canada. Where do they stand on the political spectrum and who are they guided by? In first place, we have, of course, the Liberals of Justin Trudeau, who are currently in power and who tend to be fiscally responsible but socially progressive. Liberals are strong supportive of unrestricted abortion, LGBTQ+ rights, a high rate of immigration, but also favor a market economy that is not subject to overly burdensome regulation. They try to conjugate environmentally friendly policies with economic friendly policies, which can sometimes come into conflict. Under the leadership of Justin Trudeau, the Liberals have veered a bit more to the left on the political spectrum, as they are normally found. The current second largest party in the House of Commons and the official opposition, the Conservatives of Pierre Poilievre, favor low taxes, low regulation of business, smaller government, a strong regime of law and order, a strong military, and respect for traditional values, particularly in what they view as hawkish minority activism from the left. Under the leadership of Pierre Poilievre, the Conservatives have moved a bit further to the right on the political spectrum than they traditionally are. The third largest party in the House is currently the Bloc Québécois. It is the only party sitting in the House of Commons to have regional interest for one specific province, Quebec. The Bloc Québécois' sole purpose to defend Quebec's interests and sovereignty is primarily with defending Quebec and French-Canadian values at the federal level. The Bloc does make the promotion of sovereignism, which means an independent Quebec from the rest of Canada. On the political spectrum, they are center-left, although this isn't entirely clear because in some areas they tend to be economically left-leaning, but slightly socially conservative compared to English Canada. Since they advocate only for Quebec interest, they only present candidates in Quebec ridings. The fourth largest party, the New Democratic Party, or NDP, stands for similar values as the Liberals, but is even more to the left on the political spectrum with regards to the latter. Under the leadership of Jagmeet Singh, they have advocated for measures such as the Universal Dental Healthcare Program and a Universal Medicament Public Insurance Coverage. The NDP were until recently in a coalition with the Liberals of Justin Trudeau. The last party noteworthy of mentioning are the Greens. As their name suggests, their first priority are eco-friendly policies and protecting the environment. And under the leadership of the current leader, Elizabeth May, they lean towards the center-left side of the political spectrum. The Greens and the Bloc Québécois never really participated in any government, although the current setting of the Liberals of Justin Trudeau, which are in a minority government, allows the Bloc Québécois to make gains for its political priorities. Coming back to my introduction at the beginning of this show, why could the current minority government of the Liberals of Justin Trudeau possibly fall and lead Canadians into an election? To understand this, we need to know a bit the current composition of the House of Commons. The current federal House of Commons has 152 Liberals, 119 Conservatives, 33 MPs from the Bloc Québécois, 25 Neo-Democrats, 4 Independent, 2 Greens, and 2 vacancies. Independent Member of Parliament's MPs that are not affiliated with any party. The magic number, the threshold to remember, is 169, which is the majority to obtain, representing the current 50% plus 1 majority in the House of Commons. Because the Liberals are unlikely to have support from the Conservatives, who already gave 2 non-confidence votes in the House of Commons in the last few weeks, they are very unlikely to support the Liberals. The Liberals are unlikely to have support from the Conservatives, who already gave two non-confidence votes in the House of Commons in the last few weeks. The NDP, which was in previous coalition or an agreement with the Liberals, broke this agreement a few weeks ago. This agreement allowed the Liberals to stably stay in power, because 152 Liberals plus 25 NDPs make 177, sufficiently reaching the threshold of 169 for a simple majority in the House of Commons. The NDP is unlikely to fully support the Liberals in the upcoming month because they broke an agreement where Jagmeet Singh accused the Liberals of being too weak, too egoistic, and too close to the ultra-rich to fight for the quote-unquote ordinary people. In reality, though, the Liberals are performing badly in the polls, and many political analysts think that the NDP broke the agreement with the Liberals to avoid being associated too closely with the bad poll numbers of the Liberals. The leader of the Bloc Québécois, Yves-François Blanchet, took this rupture opportunity to propose its legislation in exchange for support towards the Liberals. Otherwise, it would possibly adopt a non-confidence vote and topple the Liberals of Justin Trudeau. In my opinion, because the Liberals are polling badly and no party wants to be associated with their current bad polling, support from the NDP or the Bloc will be just enough for both smaller parties to obtain small gains on their end, with ultimately having their support short-lived. Thus, the Liberals need either support from the Bloc or from the NDP to stay in power, because support from the Bloc having 33 MPs, will procure the Liberals 185 MPs, thus exceeding the important 169 threshold. And support from the NDP, the New Democrats, will procure 25 MPs. So in my opinion, I think that both the NDP and especially the Bloc will support the current government to pass some of their key legislation, but only for a short period of time, and will eventually vote a motion of non-confidence against the Liberals to avoid being associated with their policies and their bad polling. When the government loses the House's confidence, the country will eventually run into an election. And as current polling suggests, the Conservatives are set to have a landslide victory, especially in the English-speaking part of Canada, to form the next government in power in Ottawa, having an absolute majority. This would mark an end to the current Liberal government, who has been in power for the last 9 years. A likely scenario that might also happen, which would be quite surprising given its symbolic aspect, would be to have the Bloc as the official opposition and not the Liberals. Why am I thinking this? Because the Conservatives are polling really well with English Canadians, but not particularly well in Quebec. And because Justin Trudeau has bad polling numbers a bit everywhere in the country, including Quebec. And the NDP isn't that popular in Quebec due to its secularist stand, while Jagmeet Singh, being a Sikh, wears obvious religious symbols, contrasting with Quebec's secular beliefs. This might well give the Bloc Québécois a landslide victory in Quebec, supported by high polling of provincial Quebec sovereignist parties such as the Parti Québécois. This phenomenon can be observed when looking at constituencies called La Salle et Marverdun, a Liberal stronghold which recently held a by-election left vacant by the resignation of David Lametti, former Minister of Justice, and that the Bloc took over. Thus, the next election might very well usher the Conservatives to power, and the Bloc might take some seats from the Liberal in Quebec, potentially becoming the official opposition in the House of Commons. This is it, folks. I hope you appreciated my political podcast today, and I'm looking forward to having you for my next week's show. If you have any questions or would like to submit any comments or ideas of topics to cover related to current political events, you can always write me at tsica20@ubishops.ca. That is tsica20@ubishops.ca. Thank you very much.